if had that much of an influence on him in a positive manner, what could I have done differently? And so I dug in, and I dug in hard, and I made it my mission, regardless of who it was, to understand myself to the depths, to be the leader that I needed to be for people. And it didn't get easier. I unfortunately had to pick up the pieces of some great American patriots on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan and being there for people. And I took it as a mantle on me that I was going to truly be an authentic. It was the impetus that gave me the motivation to say, I got to figure out how to do better. It was a calling to be able to do something deeper. If we start talking about developing people, you have to ask those deep questions.
After that clip, you know the rest is going to be good. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I'm a fellow traveler and a pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. Today's conversation is with Dave McGurk. Dave is a transformational leader who bridges military precision with cutting-edge organizational development. As founder and CEO of Veridin Perspective and vice president at Apogee Global RMS, Dave brings over 20 years of executive leadership experience. His impressive 30-year military career includes training operations director at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, Army Enterprise Liaison and senior executive advisor to U.S. Army European, African, and Special Operations Command teams. He has managed multi-billion dollar budgets, led teams of hundreds, and influenced policy at the highest level of government, including presidential level decisions. His approach blends 30 years of military leadership, adult education, and neuroscience to create AI-powered diagnostics, hyper-personalized development, and dynamic simulations for resilient leaders in a volatile world. Dave recently reminded me that our common connection was Chad Littlefield, a connection guru and a previous guest on Curated Questions. Dave, welcome to Curated Questions.
Ken, I'm so happy to be on here with you. You know, just so the guests know that we've had a little bit of time to get to know each other, and like our curiosity kind of merged in many areas. And I think it's just a natural progression that we have this opportunity to talk together for your audience. So thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Exactly to that point, I'm excited to actually kind of get one of these on the record, if you will, to kind of share some of that conversation with others, because it has been rich conversations, that's for sure. Let's see, I always like to start at the same point and chatting with guests, just kind of as a scene setter, and that is to ask, when did you first understand the power of questions?
I enlisted in the Army in 1987. I'm a West Point graduate. I retired with 34 years of service. And throughout the duration of my time in the military, really, you know, the curiosity and learning grew over time. And I think the moment that was really impactful to me in my career was I was an embedded advisor to the Iraqi Army in 2005 and 2006. I led a team of what was initially 5 Americans that grew to almost 40 Americans. And our responsibility was to basically grow an entire regiment from nothing. We occupied a space in Iraq that no Americans lived on. So we had to basically collaborate with the local Kurdish Iraqis. And our regiment was an Iraqi regiment, which was the first time that the Iraqi government decided to merge both Arabs from the south and the north, which was very challenging culturally. But we had to stand up a regiment from zero, and eventually it turned into a regiment of 800 doing combat missions, supporting the Iraqi army. And as I got to start understanding the leadership that I was working with, I knew that from cultural training and just being raised by great parents that everybody has a voice, and that I knew that no matter how much we could try to do for the Iraqis, they had to be able to do for themselves. So going in day one was always to my Iraqi commander, who was a former general in the Saddam army, but now he was a regimental commander as a colonel. And my first few meetings with him, we kind of set the stage that he was going to be the one that was going to be leading the effort. I was there to support him. And he's like, I want to have a meeting where we can go meet all the Iraqi officers. I want to introduce you to them. And so we said, okay, great. He's like, we'll meet tomorrow at 1 o'clock. The next day I showed up at 12:45, like the good soldier I was, because I was, it was bred into me for many years is to be early is to be on time. To be on time is to be late is to be punished. So I showed up at 12:45. I waited for an hour and 15 minutes and the officers and the colonel never showed up. So I left. I come back that evening, of course, with my American mindset and my cognitive framework. And I was like, you know, what happened? We had a meeting scheduled. And he's like, it's okay. And I'm like, well, what do you mean it's okay? And he's like, it's okay. I'm like, well, it is. It's not okay, because when we have to go do missions, if we have support waiting for us, either armed escorts or extra security convoys, we have to leave on time. He's like, don't worry. And he's like, sit down, David. And a lot of this is through an interpreter, but he had command of some English. And he's like, do me a favor. He's like, take your watch off. Take your watch off for 3 days and don't concern yourself with time. He's like, come back tomorrow. And he pointed up in the sky when the sun is about here and we can continue the conversation. So I said, okay. I went back the next day and basically talked about how important in the Iraqi culture family was, and that a meeting shouldn't supersede a family, a bonding, a cultural event that's near and dear to them. And he's like, everything else will get done. But he goes, Americans in general, and these people around the world really fixate too much on time. He goes, we don't have a lot of time in this world, so we have to make the most of the time, but we can't worry about time. And I kind of sat back and I was like, wow. Okay. You know, from someone in the military that was like very counter to what we are bred into us, right? Everything with us is about time, be on time, this time, that time. When I was enlisted soldier, I reported formation late, I had to do push-ups, on and on. And then even as an aviator flying in combat, you had to be on time because they would fire artillery in support of your arrival. We called it SEED, suppressive of enemy air defenses. You would have to make your times because you would either be there ahead, which the enemy wouldn't be suppressed, or things would be falling on you if you were late. So I did what he asked and I took my watch off. And it was kind of liberating. And I do it to this day. On the weekends, I take my watch off and I don't wear my watch. But what that really caused to me to think about it, I've had all these things programmed into my brain, ways of thinking, et cetera. And the military, and even though they tell you that, hey, we want to break you down, we want to build you back up, it's really about indoctrination. They really want you to have a cognitive framework that you operate on that's consistent with the organization. But I was like, you know what? I'm an American. I get it. Like, what else am I missing? What am I not asking myself?
Wow.
What am I not digging into myself on that is causing me to not have a more worldly perspective than I do?
Wow. Must have been quite the breaking point on many levels. I recognize we've got all kinds of structures and the indoctrination into the structures that we have around us. There would have been a little bit of unraveling over time as you encountered some of these other elements, how others engage the world.
Yeah, definitely. So what that caused me to do is I really needed to reflect. And I'm like, he's not wrong, but where's the middle ground? Hmm. And especially if you're trying to establish a fighting force, there has to be some deference given to time just because of many things. And so I went back and I had a talk with him. I'm like, I'm willing to compromise. I'm willing to accept how you approach time. if you will accept that there are certain caveats that I have based on supporting you. He's like, okay, what are those? I said, okay, so if we have to go do a mission on the road, one of the things that we provided for the Iraqi army that was unquestionably important was intelligence. And as you know, if I was going to go on the road from point A to point B, I would have to coordinate with Americans to understand what the threats were, obviously to reduce risk for not only myself, but the additional risk that I had was escorting and fighting side by side with a force that was completely different in terms of capabilities to what the Americans bring to the fight. So I basically said, I'm willing to work with you if you wanted to change training schedules and if you wanted to do whatever you need to do with your soldiers. I'm just going to ask that if I say we have to leave the gates of this compound at a specific time, or when we're on the road, the movements, we have to be bound by time. And he agreed to that. Hmm.
Seems like a reasonable compromise. Because if you've got firepower coming in, yeah, you want to be on time.
Yeah. So what followed after that is he brought all his officers in and we started having these great discussions. And I remember sitting down with him and all his officers, and he said some things and introduced me. And I told my interpreter, I said, please address the colonel, but open the floor to discussion for all his officers based on if he deems it acceptable. And I said to him, as an American who is over here supporting this country and this culture, what else do you not think I understand?
Hmm.
And they started being very expressive about what that would be. And we developed a phenomenal relationship. I mean, to the point that like we fought together, we bled together. There were soldiers that died. And at the end of the day, when I was leaving, they hosted this huge party. I mean, everybody was crying in the room. It was pretty surreal just because of the depth. And, you know, at that point in time, it wasn't any shape perception questions, you know, not really any deep, deep questions, but it was just a question that made me vulnerable to them. And it opened up doors for them to start expressing things and building kind of like a sense of trust.
I'm glad you touched on that, because that was definitely rattling around my brain, in that if you're going to have the working relationship between cultures, then there had to be some mechanism by which that bridge could be built. So yeah. opening that up. And I appreciate the vulnerability on the question, because it just left it wide open for any and all comments that were going to come back, whether you had demonstrated the stereotype of the American in front of them or not. Right. They're coming with everything they've seen in the movies, everything that they've read in the papers. I would be confident that they would be coming at you, assuming that they needed to course correct you on whatever those perceptions were. So to be able to sit there and be a part of the conversation, to really listen and gauge what is internally true for you versus I'm not beholden to that particular viewpoint, that'd be quite the experience to undergo.
It was definitely life altering, in the sense that I really truly understood that you create a lot of vulnerability when you ask the right questions, but more importantly, when you're willing to listen. So I think there's like two components of it, right? So you can ask the question, but you have to be prepared to receive the response and process a response. And then maybe it's refinement of questions after that. And then based on that interaction, I think what we have to be willing to do is we have to be willing to challenge our mental assumptions and our mental paradigms. And what I realized after dealing with the Iraqis for nearly a year is that they had a pretty fair view of Americans, but there was no reciprocity there. Most American forces that I dealt with, they looked down on the Iraqis. Mm. They were uneducated. They didn't understand the culture. And to me, I'm not just saying it's us. Every culture has its cultural, you know, egocentrism. Everybody thinks the way they do business is better than others. And yeah, I mean, you're a veteran yourself. I mean, there's no question
yep.
that American military might reigns, but it only goes so far. And I remember they would tell us you have cultural awareness. I'm like, it's not cultural awareness. You have to have cultural intelligence, because when you start talking to people and start engaging with them and to asking the questions that opens the doors, those are the things that become really powerful. And it was interesting. There was a couple of years later that I don't know how he found me, but there was a one-star general that was on the base that helped me with a few things. He was also from Arabic descent in a Kurdish area, which presented challenges. And somehow he found me years later. And he said, I miss our time together. And the place here just was never the same after you left. Because the next group of Americans, they came in, they talked to him about, they were the American Mutant Ninja Turtles, where they kept their body armor on. They stayed behind their walls. When I embedded with them, I made myself vulnerable, not just from an intellectual level, but like I wore clothes like them. I put a black jacket on, a black cap. You know, I carried my pistol underneath my jacket hidden, but I made myself vulnerable to blend in a little bit, which again, opened the doors to a lot of other things.
What do you think set you apart in your approach versus those that came behind? Why is it that you took that approach? Was that ingrained in you, or that was just your particular tactic? What did that look like?
Obviously, hindsight is 2020, and it's great for a reason. As I look back, it was really about who I was. I knew that we could go in and we could make a difference, but if we didn't create lasting change that they committed to, it wouldn't have made a difference.
Yeah.
And just looking at the world in terms of how we would operate. And again, we have great people and doing great things, but it's about creating lasting change. And if you don't create the circumstances and environment for people to embrace that and to want to drive and continue that, it's all we're doing is putting a Band-Aid on it. And not everybody approached it that way. I remember I ran into leaders that were very much about how the culture was very corrupt. I'm like, you know, well, okay, we can't. And I'm like, don't bring that up, because you bring that up, you're going to open yourself up for some serious questions. And then sure enough, this guy brought it up. And then the Iraqis were very, very well-versed in American politics, and they would cite instances. And I'm like, okay, how did that work out for you?
If you go over and push the middle of the bear trap, there is going to be a response. So,
yeah.
Wow.
So that was a very life-changing event for me for many reasons. Just for me as who I was. And I worked for, at the time, two-star General Dempsey, who went on to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who retired as a four-star. At the time, I was a major, because the guy that was the chief, he got relieved early, and I got elevated within a few weeks to the team leader position. And so I found myself coordinating with multiple countries to get vehicle shipments and trying to understand the strategic nature of what was going on with the higher headquarters. And I would literally get personal phone calls from multiple generals because they needed to update the Pentagon on what was going on. And I was in a feeding frenzy, giving them the information they want. But then I saw the reports that were going up, and they were basically like a green, yellow, red checklist, but didn't tell you what you needed to know. It was really pacification of political leadership showing progress.
Yeah.
Like, what are they really getting after? So I started having discussions with the generals. I'm like, okay, what is it that you're really looking for? You know, I get these metrics, but what are the things that you're answering specifically that I don't know behind the scenes? And I just started digging, and it helped me better understand. And I generated a completely new reporting format that went up that they adopted, because this is what we need. And it was all about answer the question, is what is the information that you need? And so the one thing that I learned is that across the board, especially with my planning nature, and then as I move forward in my career, going to the Army's Command General Staff College and getting my master's in adult and continuing education. And then ultimately I was a faculty at the Army Command General Staff College, is that questions are foundational to framing problems. Part of the military doctrine, as you go through the process, is what's the problem? Define the problem. And in the doctrine, define the problem was like buried down in multiple steps. And I'm like, nope, I pull it up. Framing the problem is ultimately the most important thing at the beginning of every venture. If corporate organizations are trying to figure out their new strategy, my first question is, what is the problem? if I'm trying to buy a new car, besides needing the car, okay, how am I going to frame my problem in terms of money, et cetera, all across the board? But questions in general are foundational to framing problems because they define the lens, the depth, and the direction through which we perceive reality and ultimately what we're trying to do. The one thing that I learned that was never taught is that the questions we ask determine what we see and what we ignore. Mm-hmm. So a shallow question is something that reveals like surface symptoms, but a depth of a question exposes hidden systems, causes misalignments. And if somebody says, well, what's wrong? Oh, this is what's wrong. We need to fix the problem. It's different than saying what I learned to start doing in educating fellow officers and for myself continuously is asking myself the question is, what am I missing? How do I see the problem? What are the facts that are relevant to the problem? And what's going to allow me to open my aperture to see a different dimension of the problem?
How did that question rubric land with those that you were teaching or bringing up behind?
It was challenging for a lot of them because, as you know, being in the military, getting back to this sense of indoctrination, right? We have to be put on a foundational, and then not everybody develops at the same pace. Everybody has different capabilities, but people got so accustomed. And the challenge that I had when I taught at the Army's Commander General Staff College, we had multi-class of year groups of officers that had spent many years in combat. Mm. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the term of CONOP.
Yeah.
So basically for many years, organizations, because they got comfortable operating in the environments they were in, they'd have a, whatever, it could have been a 5 to 10 page document. It was basically a fill in the blank. We're going to this grid, we're doing this. They had a standard methodology of presenting information to commanders for decisions. But what that does is it constrains thought processes right there. It creates a mental framework to approach the problem, which in some instances it may work, but not always. So once I started unearthing those things and challenging the officers that were coming to school to understand and frame the problem in the form of a question. Mm-hmm. And that's what I always had them do. Okay, what's our problem? How do we do this given X, Y, Z, and this? It was a question. And I said, every question has to be relevant to the problem. You have to show me why that's a relevant question. A lot of times in planning, you have to make assumptions.
Yeah,
I'd always tell them assumption is something that is absolutely necessary for planning. And we should turn it into a fact. And if you're going to make an assumption, then what is the question that you need to ask somebody to turn that into a fact? So, and that question, again, need to be very, very specific. So if you, Ken, were one of my planners that was saying, hey, we have to do aviation operations over the course of time, space to this location. And they would come up to me and say, we're assuming that the support organization can give us, say, 250,000 gallons of gas. And I would say, you have a redo. That's a horrible question to ask them because that's not getting to the specificity of what we need. Mm. And they're like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, if we are going to do aviation operations over the course of 3 days from point A to point B, what is our expected consumption rate by aircraft type? Because every aircraft burns fuel differently.
Right.
And the number of hours that we're projecting to work on every air platform that specific day over the course of all those days to get us to where we need to go. So there is a specific question that we want to know about fuel consumption rates by aircraft. And we want to know if they can support our needs. Do they have the capability to move tankers, to do whatever it is to do to get us to where we need to go? I said, that is the question that we want to ask them. We want to walk through the process as if we're going to do it, knowing that we have to go from this point to this point. And that's how you start framing questions. So yes, I agree with you. If we're going to do aviation operations for an extended period of time, I don't disagree with you with all planning tables that that's the amount of fuel you need. But that's not what we want to ask our support people.
How did folks come about receiving that and going through that learning process to understand that it is iterative? I'm sure there's some ratio that one in 10 or one in 100, you're going to nail the question perfectly the first time. But what I really want, what I'm trying to drive into is that learning process of recognizing upfront, my first question is probably not the best question. Yeah. That I need to keep driving into this and poking into the corners to try to figure out what that real question is. What was that experience like? Maybe there's tips and tricks, but just that iterative process, what did you witness that to be like, and how might you have led through that and a little bit of that story?
Yeah, so it was painful growth for a lot. Hmm. Because at that point in their career, they had never been challenged to think that deep. And it was really critical thinking. And many institutions claim that they teach critical thought, but they really don't. I mean, there's superficial aspects to it, and they get people to think hard, but to truly, to critically think, challenge your assumptions, to really reframe your questions. Am I pitching this and laying this out in the right way? You know, turning to somebody else and saying, what do you think? What do you think? The whole collaborative nature of problem solving. And what I did was I baked it in from the very beginning. So in our planning process, we came up with what were called commander critical information requirements. During the planning process, at one stage, it was what the commander needed to know in order to inform planning. And then once a course of action was adopted, it shifted to what the commander needed to know during execution, which then we talked about alternative courses of action as things progress. We call them in the military branches and sequels. The one thing I noticed, particularly when I was deployed over multiple times to combat, is I would go into command center, and what the commander needed to know was printed on a laminated piece of paper up on the wall. And I'm like, that's impossible. So we started over time misconstruing information requirements, which could lead to something like if there was a death that would generate an action where the commander would have to call back to headquarters and report a casualty, which would generate the whole notification process to family. That's an information requirement. It could be you need to be woken up for that. But in terms of what continually happens over the course of time and space, that never stays consistent because the conditions aren't always the same. And so I really drove home that you have to purge old habits, that you can't put a piece of paper up on the wall and think that those are the questions that we need to answer for somebody to make a decision, because those always change. So when I first went and we start doing different exercises, I would allow the officers to just follow their normal processes. And of course, they would print it on a couple pieces of paper and tape it to the wall. And as I would sit down and I put my pseudo commander hat on, it was the first thing I told him, I said, tear that down. I said, tear it down. I said, move a dry erase board to that location. And those questions are going to be living. And that's how it's going to be. And we're going to constantly revisit those. And what was never part of the planning process, what I always did, every single time before we started briefing them, I would say, okay, tell me, what are the things that you're struggling with? What are the questions that you're trying to figure out? What haven't you had answered? And then we'd go into the briefing and I'd be able to give them guidance. And I'd say, let's revise the questions now. Always. Mm-hmm. It was always part of the process. At the beginning, at the end of every briefing, it was a revised set of questions.
What were the differences that you saw in the students and these leaders as they graduated your class in their use of questions?
I mean, the questions that they used improved immensely. Just watching the growth of them challenging their own thoughts. And what was even better was they started challenging each other in the hopes of creating better products. And it was interesting to see some come in that, you know, were a little bit egotistical and egocentric in thought, to leave very humbled, to realize that maybe they weren't as good as they thought they were coming in, and everybody has something to learn. And that's what it was really all about. Particularly when we talk leadership, you have to be a lifelong learner. I absolutely would stand on firm ground to tell somebody that if they don't consider themselves a lifelong learner, that they can never consider themselves a leader. And then you can only consider yourself a leader if you're chosen to be a leader, which obviously creates some consternation at times, but that's okay.
My experience was, and certainly seen in the movies, it's you obey the orders and you move out. There was little room for questioning. And obviously, if fire is raining down on you, that's one thing. But the culture had been very much just obey the order. And I'm curious in that how, or curious and hopeful that some of the leadership here in that humility that they walked out the door with, perhaps it might have opened up another door that says, yeah, let me listen a little bit and let me learn from some of the folks.
Yeah. So, Matt, that's a very good question, thought-provoking. I would say I was very fortunate for the folks that I was able to work with. And out of all the close teammates that I had, I never called myself the boss. Everybody knew my position. Wasn't necessary to invoke. They knew who I was, and I treated them like teammates. And everybody that kind of worked directly for me in some form or fashion, when they got to field grade, either major or lieutenant colonel, 100% of them were selected for command and moved on. Majority of them promoted to 06. And then two of them today are general officers. I would hope that had some sort of impact on it. Because what I try to instill into them, and as you know, one of the challenges with military service or any kind of hierarchical organizations like that, even in corporate America, I experienced when I was a defense contractor, this thing called authority bias. You know, everyone thinks that because the CEO says, or the vice president says, or the general, or the commander says, that it's so. There's not a culture of question. I call it a culture of quiet. A lot of people basically just either go with the flow, get frustrated, but very few take the opportunity in the right way to, I wouldn't say challenge authority, but it's to make sure that the authority, whoever that is, gets the right perspective. And you probably heard the term before, somebody's got to tell the emperor he has no clothes on.
Right.
And I lived it. I could see disaster getting ready to come behind me. I would say, I can see the train derailment coming. And it came because nobody was willing to do anything about it. So living in that environment, it could be very challenging because, as you know, you send a commander or someone in position of authority sideways, they can have a significant mark on your career.
Right.
And I saw that happen to many people. So you've got to be very politically adept about how you do it. But at the end of the day, I finally came to the determination. Fast forward, when I'm in the Pentagon and I am running operations for a small organization that places DOD officers, and I think today they may even have some enlisted in there, which I think is very, very beneficial because it's something I was trying to get moving towards the end of my stint there, because it was about having, you know, all perspectives and supporting the United Nations. And here I am sitting in a room with two undersecretaries of defense and many other general officers, and a recommendation that was going to go to the National Security Council. And I'm listening to this banter unfold that was completely off the mark. And somebody in my shoes with that level of stars and seniority in the Department of Defense may have sat quiet and said, okay, I'll try to fix this afterwards. But I didn't. The Undersecretary of Defense at the time was a former Navy SEAL. And like, sir, if I may, and I said my piece, and like there was a in the room, like, oh my gosh. Because I kind of challenged the status quo very professionally.
Yeah.
And he pulled me aside afterwards and he's like, you know, you got a set on you, I'll give you that, but you're not wrong. So he looked at two generals and they said, listen to him and let's get this fixed. And this is what people say. I heard a lot of times you'll hear leaders and people in all kind of industry and say, yeah, I need to be told what happens, but it's not always the case in practice, because sometimes it's not the person who's making the decision. Sometimes it's the gatekeepers that keep you from getting there.
Yeah.
It's having to navigate that complexity, and you're dealing with humans. And so it's not always easy.
Mm.
So getting back to questions, like kind of like fast forward to today and where we're at, I was in the defense contracting world and I needed to pivot to do something to challenge myself. And I was very fortunate to cross paths with MK Palmore, Apogee, and I'm on now as his vice president for strategy and leader development. I have my own consulting side of the house too, which is part of what I do with MK. Mm. But I think we can agree that whatever question we ask, it directs our time and focus. Bad questions waste energy. Good questions focus, right? In the world that we have, especially in business, and dependent upon time of decisions, et cetera, we don't have the luxury of time. So we want to use our time most efficiently. So that's one thing is, like I said, good questions focus our efforts. I found a lot of the times that where I started really digging into myself was we have mental models. The analogy that I like to use, especially if we're in the tech space, is that when we're born, our brain is a blank hard drive. As we get older, our brain is coded with cognitive frameworks, and that could be based on parental shaping, religious affiliations. As you go to school, teachers, coaches, friends, your environment, it all shapes how we view the world. And everybody has different mental models, obviously, because we all are not in the same time and space at any given time. And what I have found that every problem exists inside of one of our mental models. Questions either reinforce that model or disrupt it. I have always endeavored to figure out how do I disrupt it, because I don't look to reinforce, because reinforcement could actually be a byproduct of our mental model, our cognitive framework. Yeah. But if I look to disrupt it, in an attempt to disrupt it, I maintain it, that sort of validates. But again, there could be some fault in that, and am I trying to disrupt it in the right way? So I'm always looking at how to reframe my thought, to understand how I think. And I really started digging into that. I got a master's in adult education. I went back to teach at the Army Commander General Staff College, and I taught a course in creative thinking and how to generate creativity and et cetera. I would just do some simple drills with my students. I'd put 10 math problems on the board and make number 7. I'd make it always wrong. So 10 problems, number 7 was wrong. I put up on that, what do you see? And they said, oh, anyone see anything? Oh yeah, number 7. It says 1 times 1 is 2. It's really 1. Like, okay, anyone else see anything? Everyone jumped on the wrong. I'm like, okay, so we have 90% right out of 100. Why did you jump on the one that was wrong? For some reason, we've been coded to focus on the negative. You got an A on the test. Well, could you have done better? You know, I got this many wrong. We beat ourselves up. So I'm not saying that's holistic across society and cultures, but generally speaking, people tend to focus on the negative. You've probably in the military service
absolutely
was involved in maybe an after action review or a self critique of what's going on. What does everybody start doing? Everybody starts thumping about, man, you should have done this. We should have done that. That was bad. I'm like, hey, we did this good. I'd get to work in. Okay, well, we need to prove this. And so it was always interesting, but I nonetheless would try to help people understand what their paradigms were. Like, what are the things that you think about that really drive the way you think? And then powerful questions, they basically challenge our inherited codes and cognitive biases. So if I was going through a process of decision-making, there's a book by Kahneman out there, Thinking Fast and Slow, that talks about how the brain works.
Right.
And I'd be like, okay, so how does your brain work? What do you mean? How does your brain work? Right. So think about it as a file cabinet. Your brain works as something hits your brain. You want to go to the top drawer of that file cabinet because it's easiest. That's your intuitive side of the house. But if you got to bend over and go to the bottom drawer or get on your hands and knees to open the drawer, that's painful. And that's really your analytic side. And your brain wants to maximize reward or minimize threat. So let's go for the top drawer and call it good. But you can't do that. So it was helping them understand how the brain works, how they think about things, and what are those cognitive biases that are preventing them from framing the problem in the right way, or how to challenge their cognitive biases. So they didn't know what they were. So if in any organization, if the person who sits at the top of the food chain is the one that if they say everyone believes that, yep, whatever they say goes, I'm like, how do we challenge that? Not necessarily challenge that person, but how do we challenge our own ability to understand how we're thinking and how we're going to make a difference for us? And if we can make a difference for us in a collaborative environment, we can make that much more of a difference across the board.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others.
I appreciate the work that you've been doing to understand these mental models and pressing back, trying to understand the biases. How might the regular use of questions or the questioning practice get one to recognize that they're always going to the top drawer and to be aware that my default is that and I need to go to the bottom drawer. I need to expend the extra energy. How can we develop a questioning practice or a way of living that ensures that we look beyond just the top drawer?
So one, I think somebody has to have I wouldn't say an in-depth understanding. People just have to understand that first and foremost, how the brain works. Most developmental systems don't do that. And most people don't realize that the human brain is a pattern recognition system. It's a machine. It recognizes patterns that are coded in our hard drive, and it recognizes those patterns and it operates on those patterns. And just like a computer has an operating system, so do we. It's our subconscious, and it's driven by beliefs, values. There's a whole bunch of things that's baked into that. And our brain relies on mental shortcuts because our brain wants to avoid cognitive dissonance, which gets back to the fact that it's two functions of maximizing reward and minimizing threat. And what our brains do is, I like to use the term echoes. We have all these echoes of the past. If you can imagine, have you ever taken a picture or flashed, went back in the day when cameras had flashers or Polaroids, and your family's coming over and they want to get that Polaroid and you got to shake it to get it to develop. Remember, if you got that thing snapped, like, you could close your eyes and you could see that image.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I can't say we all have done it, but I think people could resonate. I look up at the sun and I look away and I could still see the sun. The brain kind of works that way. The brain defaults to past interpretations. And it starts to create solutions based on our past interpretations. And it frames based on what we're already familiar with. And it's introducing people to that. And what I would do is I would give them a problem that they would be familiar with. And I would know exactly how they would go about trying to frame it and solve it. And they would do exactly what I want them to do because that's the way we're programmed. And then I'd be able to kind of step back and show them a process. And then I would say, this is how your brain works. This is what you did. And in adult education, I use what was called the experiential learning model.
Okay.
Adults need an anchor. We have great experience in our life, and not everybody has an experience which you can depart from in terms of creating new meaning for somebody. And so I created an anchor point with some of those examples for them, and I would basically have it laid out. Here's the problem, and I would come up with a solution. Here's exactly how you're going to solve it, and I would hand it to somebody. I'm like, don't turn that over, and they go through the process. Okay, turn it over. I'm like, it was like a magician, giving me a card, and I told them a card was in their hand, and I said, well, here's why it would happen. And what it was really to do is, it's really dangerous because it would potentially solve the wrong thing. You'd repeat the same cycle and you would never transform. You would just potentially optimize dysfunction. And would give them examples of things that I dealt with in all facets of my life and career that those same type of things happen. So what I would teach them to do is we have to learn first and foremost, what are our reflexive interpretations of the things are? What are those echoes that kind of govern how we think? And we got to ask at that point for ourselves deeper framing questions. So one of the things that I always told them is, okay, here's two situations that are very similar. If we map out the conditions, are they similar? What assumptions had to be made here that was turned into facts that are still applicable here? And if you can imagine, I would put up a circle on the board and I would parse that circle up into different components. And then I would do 10 circles that were different. And I'm like, each one of those circles represents a different snapshot in time. And those different pies of the circle that are changing are all things that you know that you don't know and things that you need to go after. And then you have to constantly reframe what it is you're looking for based on that. There's no question that exists in perpetuity. You have to go and figure it out and make sure that it's constantly doing the same thing. And then how do we match that against what we think our inherited mental model is that is driving that for us? And then after that, you've got to get outside of that cognitive loop. It's like almost having an out-of-body experience. Look at yourself and say, am I aware of those shortcuts that my brain is making? Am I a reflection of the rewiring and the response? And then how do I change the framework?
It reminds me that through our mental models, through our experience, we've arrived at today with, and we've built systems that have allowed us to reach the level of success that we have. And that may not necessarily be the ones that we need to carry forward.
Yeah, exactly right.
We need to be aware of that and then to be able to question those such that we can continue to grow and learn and to go on to whatever the next levels are.
Yeah.
But there needs to be a consciousness to actually getting after that. Because otherwise it's just going to take brute force of a hard experience of learning the hard way.
Yeah, exactly right, Ken. Exactly. Take a look at sports. You look at NFL football, and coaches are constantly looking at plays, how to revise plays, right? Their framework, it's not necessarily the same at the cognitive level, but they have a framework in which they operate their offense versus defensive schemes. They're studying the opponent all the time. They're constantly revising their structure and how they're going to try. But we need to do the same thing as human beings. We need to understand our structure. Almost synonymous with, okay, this is the offensive concept I'm running. And then constantly going to refine that, what that looks like. And then our defensive structure is exactly what our brain does. We have so many deep ingrained beliefs and paradigms in our body where we've got to constantly try to excavate, try to figure out what is this doing to me? So that's where I've arrived at now, because I've thought about it in my many years of experience, right? So again, 34 years of service, I'm a West Point grad, adult education master's. I've taught at West Point, and I wrote the leadership development curriculum for the Corps of Cadets. I was an instructor, and I became a team leader at the Army's Commander General Staff College. And I was also, when I was still active duty, was the first military member that was put onto the faculty development committee, meaning I was one of the guys that stood up in front of all the new faculty and taught them how to be teacher.
Right.
And so it wasn't by accident. It wasn't because Dave was this super amazing person, but it's because I learned at an early point in my career to adopt the mantle of self-development and just aggressively pursue that all the time. And to be able to look at myself in the mirror, because it's very hard for us to hold mirrors up to ourselves. Like to be in a relationship with somebody that holds a mirror up for you that you can, but to hold the mirror up to ourselves continuously, that's not something that like we're designed to do by cognitive framework. And it's challenging.
I appreciate your leaning in to that. Do you have any idea where that came from? Was that something that, I don't know if it was a parent's kind of driving things into you? Why did you choose to get after this and pursue really understanding and embracing the personal growth under a very broad umbrella?
So I think it was a culmination of events over the years. I've always been eager to learn and dug in, but I think one of the turning points for me was after I graduated from the Command General Staff College, post my embedded advisor time, where I was working with the Iraqis, I went to Fort Drum, New York to take command. And I took command in August, and not more than 4 months later, I had a soldier, the first one, a soldier that committed suicide. Mm. And you've been in the military. I think the military doesn't do justice to the whole concept of suicide avoidance awareness. I mean, they do a lot of great things. Don't get me wrong. Nobody will ever know when someone makes that tragic decision to take their lives. And it's such a huge bureaucracy. But there, and I'll get to this in a second, but there's a depth that to which we don't go through. And I was always really good. My father was a retired enlisted soldier, and he always told me, wherever you're at, never forget your ground roots, right? Never forget where you came from. And he'd always tell me, in the absence of a soldier, soldiers would be soldiers. And I never understood that for many years. And then I finally realized it was no matter where you're at in the world, no matter what your rank is, if you're not a soldier first, soldiers won't soldier. So I always made it my daily effort to connect with people, regardless of how large the organizations were.
Gotcha.
End of every month, we had birthday parties. I bought cakes. We did things to connect with people, the soldiers of mine that were going through, you know, I had an open door. If you're going through marital problems, if you have financial problems, come in, let's talk. I'm here to help you and support you. And I had one of my soldiers, Jeremy LeClaire, that came in and he started talking about some of the things that he was going through. And on a tragic night, a couple weeks before Christmas, Jeremy decided to take his life. And it was a really pivotal moment for me. And, you know, what the Army did was, like any military service, they did an investigation. And unbeknownst to me, part of their investigation, which they called a psychological autopsy, I got called to the division, the two-star general's office. And I'm like, this is unusual. So I go to the general's office. And back at that time, the services have always gone back and forth on zero defect mentality, right? Can you make mistakes, not make mistakes?
Gotcha.
And,
right. Yeah.
I mean, I was like, okay, maybe there was something that they found that basically they attribute to poor leadership. I didn't think so. But I went in the office and like, okay, what's going on? And he basically sat me down and he's like, I want to thank you. He goes, we have unfortunately had to deal with many suicides in this organization. And the military had been back and forth in the war zones for years. And it was starting to take a toll on service members and their families. And he said, but he goes, this is the first time that when the psychiatrist went back through and reviewed all the records that your name in every single counseling session was mentioned. And I thought to myself, man, sorry if I get a little emotional.
No.
Like, man, what did I do wrong? If I was... had that much of an influence on him in a positive manner, you know, what could I have done differently? And so I dug in. And I dug in hard. And I made it my mission, regardless of who it was, to understand myself to the depths, to be the leader that I needed to be for people. And it didn't get easier. I unfortunately had to, you know, pick up the pieces of some great American patriots on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan and, you know, being there for people. And I took it as a mantle on me that I was going to truly be an authentic. I think I already was, but it was the impetus that gave me the motivation to say, I got to figure out how to do better. And I didn't have any of these grandiose ideas, like I was going to be able to fix anything or to prevent something. But at least for me, it was a calling to be able to do something deeper. And one of the things that I started doing over the years, which I do now, if we start talking about developing people, you have to ask those deep questions. Questions are extremely, extremely important and invaluable to development. So what I've kind of learned is that, getting back to the analogy I made earlier, is we all have these mental models that we exist on. They're programmed into our subconscious and our brain that we operated on. They make decisions for us. They frame problems. And we don't always know what's going on. I've always endeavored to say, what is it that's going on? I always want to be able to understand what's going on. And it's lifelong. We're humans. We're complex. As we age, as we have experiences in our life, with personal relationships or whatever it may be, we're constantly evolving. So it's always an ongoing process. And it has to become repetitive in our daily lives to truly understand what are those reflexive interpretations that are coming? What are those echoes that are coming back and feeding us? And when I really boiled down to it, I thought back, you know, I said, you know, what was it that I made a difference in with people, that why people always looked at me and said, Dave, you're a phenomenal leader. You're like a leader that I've never encountered and I've never encountered since. And I have a lot of people that have stayed in touch with me and friends of mine and that have moved on, senior levels of government and subordinates that I call teammates that are now coming up in senior level positions still really stay connected with me because I challenge them. I help them challenge themselves. And I reached out to folks that I worked before. I said, just kept it simple. I'm like, hey, just what was it about me that made you think that I was a good leader? Just an open-ended, easy question. And the answers came back and there were some consistencies and it was about, you saw me, you heard me, you felt me. And I'm like, what is that? I started thinking of what does that mean? And what I realized is that we all have a story. We all have an operational framework, our cognitive framework that we abide by. I made it my goal to understand every single person that I interacted with. And sometimes it was different. So you and I can talk today and your mental framework may be different tomorrow because you're presented with something. or somebody I was dealing with today, tomorrow, they could have found out some bad news about their health or their parents, and they're different. So every day is an inner terrain that we have that we have to understand, and that our inner terrain is manifested by what we do, say, and how we interact with others. Mm. And it's constantly understanding that. So it, what became systematic was everyone's like I said, you saw me, you heard me, you felt me. You truly made me feel like I was important and that you connected with me. And the only way that we can connect with people, we first have to connect with ourselves. And that's asking the deep and the excavating and the hard questions. So now when I talk to people, you know, one of the questions that I like to use, given the fact that we have cognitive models that shape who we are, what we do, how right. we think, like what book we decide to pick up and read. And I ask them, what invasive cognitive model has colonized your mind without your permission?
That is an amazing question. And I appreciate the term colonized in there. What is that question really trying to get at the heart of?
It's really trying to get at the heart of people taking an opportunity to examine their inherited mental models that frame their existence. It helps to generate discussion because in all my years in education, in all my years of going through like military developmental programs, they get at the periphery. So I've gone through classes, as probably you have, this, oh, these are biases. This is a logical versus an illogical argument. And this is why problem framing is important. But never in all of my time, in my 34 years, did any institution or anyone ever look at me and say, Dave, you know, you operate based on the mental framework that you have in your head. What is that? What are the mental models that you harbor? And then the majority of them, and I use the term colonized or inherited, we don't choose them. Hmm. So one of the mental models that I choose now is to constantly reframe, to put myself in a state of cognitive dissonance to continue to learn. And that's from learning how I make decisions. It's understanding, you know, taking an emotional intelligence assessment. I've done all the MBTIs, the learning styles inventories. I've done all these things to uncover who it is and how I think. But the important fact there is the concept is you get as many perspectives as you can, but you've got to hesitate and be careful about labeling yourself. And I say that because you can take an MBTI, you've probably taken that before, and people are like, oh, hey, good morning, I'm an ENTJ, or good morning, I'm an INTJ, or how you doing? You label yourself. But on any given day, it's arguable that somebody could bounce back and forth between certain quadrants, and they can be a blend of certain things. And some of these assessments that you can take that color code individuals, well, I'm a blue, hey, good morning, I'm a yellow, that's really too superficial. And I like to use, and you probably heard it before, the whole iceberg piece. Right. Mm-hmm. What you see of an iceberg can be a tip above the water, but below the water is a mammoth structure. And to me, that mammoth structure below the surface is your inner terrain. It's all those things that kind of make you who you are, your cognitive frameworks, you know, your paradigms and how you view the world. That's all below the surface. All we see at the above the tip of the iceberg, all we see is a manifestation of that in your outer terrain. And I've never had anybody say, hey, let's take a look at the subsurface aspect of what's going on, how that creates a manifestation with people in the world, in your existence. It's just, there's nothing out there that kind of gets at that. There's a lot of psychology and there's all certain things. And there's books out there that talk about barriers to change and immunities to change and how we have these cultural legacies of thought processes that are pervasive in societies and cultures, et cetera. It's great. But when I talk about developing people, particularly leaders, that's never been done. I'm doing it.
Nice. That's why I wanted to have this conversation. How does ego fit into all of this story?
Ego doesn't fit into the story because egocentric thought is what prevents people from the first place from actually excavating those mental models. And you've probably run into people before. You could not tell them anything. I mean, you could show them that the train is coming down the track and you can show them exactly where it's going to derail. And that doesn't matter. The train derails. It's because sometimes there's mental models that are so ingrained in people that you can't do anything about it. And I've experienced that with folks in senior levels of government. For whatever reason, they got to where they're at. It's not even government. It was in business too. They got to where they were at because they had a really good skill set that elevated them, or they did really well at money. But then when you start to involve people and leadership, it just wasn't present. And egocentric thought is an extreme barrier to anybody to learn about themselves, let alone other people. You have to be willing to put your ego aside. You have to be willing to admit that you're wrong. And that's just the way, to me, you've got to go about viewing the world, is constantly asking yourself, is this the right perspective? How do I shape that perspective? And then getting an alternative perspective on it. So one of the practices that I adopted probably should have been sooner, but you know, we are all a function of learning and growing. But by the time I got to about my 20th year of service, I realized that everybody in my ecosystem was part of my feedback mechanism. So I would bring in teammates and like, we'd talk about performance counseling, and I would sit down weekly or biweekly, dependent upon how busy we were. I tried for a weekly, and it was nothing more than a quick chat, and then followed up on an iterative basis to document performance and goals and et cetera. So people always knew where they stood and where they needed to go. And I started in my office. I would sit in my desk in the chair, and then I would have my teammate sit on my couch. And I would say, hey, look, here's what I've seen in the past week. Here's what I think is very good about what you're doing, and get a little bit, hey, how are you doing? Just that interpersonal piece. How's your wife? Yeah, you get a birthday next week. How does it feel to be getting old? I heard your knees cracking on the run the other day. Just to show myself that I was a human being, and I never had to be the boss or the commander. And after I got done with what I wanted to say, we would swap seats. I'm saying, you sit in my chair, I'm going to sit on the couch, and I want you to tell me how I'm doing. And the first few times, that really shocked people. They're like, what? Oh, no, sir, you're doing amazing. And I was like, and I had a penalty flag that they have in the NFL, like a little rock, like a little yellow handkerchief around with a rubber band.
Yeah.
And as soon as they would do that, I would throw it on the table. I'm like, I just threw the, and I wrote BS on the flag. I just threw the BS flag. You got to give me something. And then over time, it turned into an environment where there was flowing feedback. And then once I was able to earn their trust and create that psychological safety net for them, then because I got to know them on a personal level and I got to have conversations with them about what's important to you and how do you see this problem set? And it developed these relationships that by the time we left, and mind you that when I got this, then I got a staff of almost 50 that was thrown together 4 months before we left for a year deployment. And I had to get to know everybody really quickly. By the end of that deployment, I had senior folks in government saying, dude, how did you do that? How did you take that staff and turn it into such a machine in such a short period of time? I said, because it's all about people. It's all about connections. And there's many ways of doing that. But I knew that I couldn't always be everywhere at all times. I needed people to be able to be empowered to make decisions, do the right thing, and constantly question themselves. And that's the one thing, is that when we got on a deployment, I noticed that a lot of folks would sit in the headquarters. And I'm like, how are our customers doing? Our customers being the folks that we support. And so in Afghanistan, we were in 7 different locations. And I would talk to my staff. I was like, you know, when was the last time you truly understood and got a deeper level understanding of the problems and the questions of the folks that needs our help? And so I made it mandatory that, okay, like once every 3 weeks, you need to get on an airplane. You need to go spend 2 days with a customer and rotate it, just getting down. And I diffuse the situation. I'm like, we don't want to create this mountain. We've got to operate on a level playing field. And in order to operate on that level playing field, you have to get out and about, understand. But that all started with connecting with people. It all started understanding how they were framing the world. And then that allowed me to slowly to shape and mentor them, to help them develop their, you know, their cognitive skills, their cognitive mental models that, you know, that helped everybody across the board.
I appreciate the tangible example of swapping seats, just from being in the spaces where you've got senior officials or officers, and sitting in their seat is taboo.
Yeah.
And by breaking or challenging that taboo, and as you say, creating that psychological safety through relationships and such, I could see how that would allow for that candor and real connection to be made. I can understand why you've had much of the impact that you had and why folks keep reaching out to you with those established relationships. So
thank you. You're too kind. But it's amazing what that can do.
Yeah.
I mean, we all have bad days, right? Yeah. So when I was running the ops for an organization in Afghanistan, we had one of our aircraft shot down, one of our pilots killed. It was a 58-hour battle to secure the aircraft and get our dead American back. And it was excruciating. But when you have that relationship with people, when you help shape their reflexive interpretations and echoes of what's going on in the world, and, you know, I'm tired. At the time, I didn't do coffee or caffeine, and I snap because I'm tired, and I'm having all these senior officials trying to call me on my video screen to get an update, and I just unplugged it. I'm like, leave me alone. I'll get back to you when I can get back to you. And I go into a meeting, again, asking really good questions about, you know, it's not just how much fuel we have left. It's, I want to know specifically by airframe what the fuel requirements are as we continue this operation. There's the number of aircraft we have. This is the fuel. This is the ammunition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then if I kind of get a little flippant, I have one of my teammates that, like, in an open forum, you know, and they look at me and they go, all right, sir, that's not you.
Mm.
And literally would stand up in the room and I'm like, okay, I accept accountability for me. I apologize. You did not deserve that. And I sat down and let's move on. And it was water under the bridge. So by creating that deep connection with someone and help shape their view of the world and shape, and basically, again, mental models, right? Everybody was programmed to authority bias.
Right.
If the boss or the colonel or somebody says this, let's just do it. To me, that wasn't acceptable. That wasn't acceptable. When you had people's lives on the line, we're human. We're fatigued, except I want to be challenged all the time. And the only way that I could set the stage to be challenged is to have them sit across from me at first, and you need to counsel me. You need to tell me where I need to improve. We need to establish a relationship where there's free-flowing information, that there's trust. And that's the way it goes. And years later, I brought up to a CEO, I said, how would you feel like if you would have one of your VPs sit down and give you counseling about what you're doing? And he looked around and he goes, are you crazy? Like, why would I do that? I mean, I'm just curious, but it didn't matter because he didn't get it.
Yeah, you've kind of answered the question by virtue of the, without even answering the question, you've answered the question. What elements are you most excited about in this next season that you're going into with all that you've been creating?
I'm really excited to develop these opportunities. And just to take my passion for what I have learned and how I've grown and share it with other people in a unique way. But I'm also not naive to know that some people are not going to want to take the path. Mm. Because it takes courage, right? Truly hold the mirror up to yourself, it takes a lot of courage. And it takes somebody that, if nothing else, has a little bit of an inherited framework to understand that improvement is always continuous. And regardless of how I break into the space, I'm passionate about doing it. And because I think people matter. I spent decades in service, like very, very blessed to be able to lead America's sons and daughters in combat. And not everybody always came home, but it was an immense honor and a responsibility that was bestowed upon me, not by a title, but by the people that allowed me to do it. And people are so important. And if people just could stop, and I understand it's a busy world, and you start talking about development in corporate America, and it's about return on investment, and about this and about that. If I can at all shape the perspective about how important people is, and don't get me wrong, there are a lot of people out there that believe that people are important, that people need to be empowered.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I've come to the determination of is that the status quo has been accepted for so long. And it's not that our brains about development have been corrupted, but they've been programmed by a system that is superficial, right? Everybody focuses on the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And we talk leader development, they talk about, oh, you need to be empathetic. You need to be a good communicator. But it all goes back to the internal terrain. If I don't know what's preventing me from being a good communicator, if I don't know what's preventing me from having a more open perspective about things, if I don't know why I'm not empathetic, I can't do anything about it. So it's not about skills. It's about a deep connection to yourself then through which you can connect with others. And one of the other things that I'm excited about doing is helping people understand that you've probably seen it across multiple spaces. Modern leadership. We need modern leadership today. There's no modern leadership. Leadership is leadership. Mm. Leadership is truly deeply connecting with yourself to connect with others. And I believe that as individuals, we have to lead ourselves. We have to build connection and drive growth. And growth does not occur unless there's a connection. It could be superficial. It could be whatever. And the more people and organizations that empower people, that adopt the mindset that by, with, and through people is where everything happens, those are the organizations that become ultimately successful.
That is an exciting spot to be with the passion and the drive that you've got. I'm excited for changes and the impact that you're going to be able to make.
I'm also excited too with Apogee. The CEO, MK Palmer, just asked me to take on the podcast, the Leadership Student 2.0 podcast.
All right.
I think that's going to be another venue. But of course, with your expertise in the space here, Ken, I'm going to, at some point in time, ask you to take me to school and to help me get into the right cognitive loop about how to approach this new enterprise, which you do amazingly well. My hat's off to you. I think it's an exciting space that you're in. I think curated questions is something that is an amazing topic that we all need to do. It creates this space for us to really think about what we're going to ask for all the things that we talked about. And I know as I'm a continual student, I always look forward to watching your podcast and the amazing guests you have on and how you so eloquently navigate the conversations. And I learn from you all the time. So I appreciate what you're doing.
That is encouraging, especially for someone that pursues excellence with such intentionality. That means a lot. I appreciate that. Yeah. As we look towards wrapping up here, did we miss anything about questions? Any openings or ground that we didn't turn over that's important that we touch on?
I think the last thing that I would say on questions, and based on everything that we've discussed, a question boils down to a choice. And we have many choices in life. We talked recently that a question boils down to agency. Mm. And if you don't truly understand your cognitive framework, the questions that you frame, the question you want to ask may not ever get to the depth to which they need be. If you want to execute agency, a choice about what you're seeking and what you're going after, you have to make sure that how you're framing the question is appropriately framed by your mental model. And I don't think there's the chicken versus the egg piece of it. It's you truly have to understand. I think as we've evolved, I think especially you too, as you've gotten into this space of curated questions, I think the questions that you probably ask now and after having spent some time with guests who ask really good questions and thought-provoking questions has forced you to think about the questions that you ask. You know?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Very, very much so. And then also just layering in with, as I continue, so there's the question loop, but then there's also, as to your point, the mental model loop, which is informing that question loop. It's just that continuous loop of goodness of getting better, learning, and driving growth. I'm excited for approaching episode 50 here, that by the time that I get to 100, I should be better, right? We should see growth. If we didn't, then I missed out on opportunity here.
I don't know if you thought about it. What would be neat is if maybe one of your episodes, you go back and you ready for this?
I'm ready.
You curate content out of those episodes is almost like a, here's the best of, or maybe not the best of, but whatever you want to frame it as, go back and say, hey, here, I've just curated some really impactful things that have helped me move forward in this. And we kind of something neat to see.
Yeah. And I think that within that, it allows the opportunity for not just the highlights, but the things that I missed. Like one of my favorite examples of a whiff was that in the conversation with poet Nikki Giovanni, because she says, I think it's three times during this long discussion that we had that she really, really wanted to have this discussion. And then she states that she never asks questions. And I'm like, what? And I failed to ask a follow-up question. I'm like, hello, that is the spot to ask that question. I love Nikki Giovanni for the woman that she was and all that she represented. But for me, there is growth in this thing that I'm doing of curated questions and seeking to get better. So I want to share the highlights, but also laugh at myself and absolutely identify those missed opportunities as well. Yeah.
Yeah. You can almost do like a highlight reel with a Ken Woodward bloopers. Oh, didn't ask that. Look at that little explosion.
Well, missed that one. Yep. Yep. Before we wrap things up, I do have this other longstanding question of just asking folks, what is their right now question? What are the questions that you're working with right now for you personally?
I think for me, as I endeavor into this leadership development space, besides continuously like refining my understanding of the human psyche, is I like to ask myself, as I go into this, and it's born out of some of the planning and years of, it's not where I'm going to fail, but I like to ask myself, how are you going to experience catastrophic success? And what does that look like?
Wow. That certainly would challenge the mental models that challenges mine, but also the where we most often think about risk and the like of catastrophic success. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Going back to what we talked earlier, we always tend to, not always, we sometimes tend to focus on the negative. Mm. Remember the 10 question, the 10 math problems, everyone focused on the one wrong. Yeah. Not the 90% right, but the one wrong. And I said sometimes, and I've learned over many years in organizations, they're trying to prevent failure.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what about if we achieve catastrophic success? How are we going to deal with that? And so that's where my brain, my mental model goes, understanding in the background, I'm constantly refining and trying to make sure I'm getting the right perspective. But failure is a part of growth. It's going to happen. It should happen. Most people that you talk to in business will always tell you that, yeah, I failed a lot of times. And you watch these shows on TV where people say, yeah, I was told no many times. It's going to happen. It's a part of growth. And you kind of embrace the fact that there's growth and it's not about how you fall, but it's how you pick yourself up. But I'm like, what if we focus on catastrophic success and what does that mean to us and how much turbulence that could bring us if we look at from that perspective? So to me, that's a little bit of the paradigm and mental model that I'm looking at is what does that look like?
That's a good spot to be. Cool.
Yes, sir.
All right. Where's the easiest place for folks to track you down or see what you're excited about?
So obviously, if they go to apogeeglobal.rms, they could find us. Obviously, David McGurk, I'm on LinkedIn. There's definite ways there to get on our calendar and see where we're going. And obviously, as we start to get more time in the space, I'm going to be getting on a speakers tour and doing multiple things. So eventually, we're going to be a little bit of a disruptor in the space. But I welcome engagement. I look forward to engaging with people. And I endeavor to the best of my ability to always grant people some time. And you know this is probably as well as I do. It's sometimes people get to a point and they develop a circle around them when they become untouchable. It's hard to get to people. And That's not what I'm about. I'm about providing access as best I can provide it, and just having that great interaction and dialogue to push the bubble on human development.
Excellent. Well, that's certainly has been my experience with you. I'm grateful for that. So Dave, thank you for the work that you are doing. Well, first off, thank you for the service that you did to the country and the manner in which you did the service to the country and the lives that you touched there. So thank you for that. And then thank you for the work that you're doing now in pulling all these parts together to really understand the best way forward for those that want to fully embrace the leadership journey going forward. So I'm excited about the work that you're doing, and just thank you for being on Curated Questions, man. Thank you.
Ken, I appreciate it. You humble me. I thank you for your service to the nation as well as your veteran and what you are doing as well to literally expound thought processes and people's frameworks. And I'm really excited about getting to know you better. I think we're friends, we're become deeper friends, and I'm excited about my journey. I'm just so thankful for you taking the opportunity to let me to come on here and have this great discussion, and look forward to our future together.
Excellent. All we do is go up. Thanks, man.
All right, man. Thank you.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Ken here. Dave's wisdom and insights were on full display during this conversation. I'm excited for you to integrate these insights into your engagement with the world around you. I've compiled 4 key takeaways and will share them with you in just a moment. I just wanted to share that I am delighted with the recent influx of newsletter subscribers who have signed up to the bi-monthly distribution from the Curated Questions homepage at curatedquestions.com. While you're there, click the link to record your right now question, which may be included in an upcoming episode. Now, on to the takeaways. Number 1, the watch off revelation. During his 2005-2006 deployment as an embedded advisor to the Iraqi army, Dave's Iraqi commander challenged him to remove his watch for 3 days and stop fixating on time. This seemingly simple request became a profound moment of cultural awakening, revealing how deeply his cognitive frameworks had been shaped by military indoctrination. The experience taught him to ask, "What else am I missing? What questions am I not asking?" This pivotal moment shifted his approach from cultural awareness to cultural intelligence, demonstrating that breakthrough insights often arise from examining our most fundamental assumptions about how the world works. Question: what inherited beliefs about, quote, the right way to operate might you be clinging to without questioning their validity in different contexts? Number 2, questions as problem framing architecture. Dave discovered that questions are foundational to framing problems. They define the lens, the depth, and the direction through which we perceive reality. Rather than accepting the military's approach of burying problem definition deep in the planning process, he moved it to the forefront. He teaches that shallow questions reveal surface symptoms, while deep questions expose hidden systems and root causes. The questions we ask literally determine what we see and what we ignore. His approach is to always ask, "What am I missing? How do I see the problem? What are the facts relevant to the problem?" To open the aperture for different dimensions of understanding. Question: how might your current problem be completely reframed if you ask, "What am I missing?" instead of, "How do I solve this?" Number 3, the invasive cognitive model framework. Dave asked people to examine, what invasive cognitive model has colonized your mind without your permission? This provocative question cuts to the heart
of inherited mental models, the cognitive frameworks programmed by parents, teachers, culture, and experience that shapes our existence without conscious choice. He uses the iceberg metaphor. What people see, behaviors, communication styles, etc., is just the tip. The massive structure below the surface is your, quote, inner terrain, the cognitive frameworks and paradigms that create your outer manifestation. Most leadership development focuses on the tip, the skills like communication or empathy, without excavating the subsurface beliefs that prevent those skills from developing. Question: which of your firmly held beliefs did you actually choose versus inherit from your environment? And are they still serving you? Number 4, the seat swap counseling method. Dave revolutionized feedback by literally swapping seats during performance counseling sessions. After giving his feedback from the desk chair, he had moved to the couch and have his team member sit in his chair to counsel him on his performance. When people initially deflected with, "You're doing amazing, sir," he'd throw a literal yellow BS flag on the table. This practice created psychological safety and established that authority bias wouldn't be tolerated. The result? Flowing two-way feedback, empowered decision-making, and teams that became machines in record time. His mantra, "You saw me, you heard me, you felt me." People felt genuinely seen because he had made understanding their cognitive frameworks his systemic goal. Question: what would change in your relationships if you literally or figuratively swap seats with those you lead or work alongside? I know you had some moments that particularly resonated with you. I'd love to see them in the comments section on your respective podcast player. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with the episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.